Clad in claustrophobic armored suits, bomb technicians waddle up to suspect packages armed with training, experience, and a pair of pliers. The suits leave their most delicate instruments uncovered, their hands. Dogs can detect explosives, and there are portable X-ray machines to look inside. Robots and other high-tech devices can be useful, but bomb techs often rely on a pocket knife and a prayer. Since 9/11, even a greasy paper bag left unattended can be enough to summon the bomb squad. In 2004, ABC News reporters Richard Esposito and Ted Gerstein spent a year inside the little-known world of the New York City bomb squad to learn more about the deadly game of chess between the technician and the bomber, about the training, the sweeps, the false alarms and the hoaxes, about who these guys are and why they're willing to walk toward a device they know might kill them. Later in the hour, we'll talk with the officer who was in charge of Camp Fallujah Regional Detention Facility in Iraq. He's former Marine Mike Carlson. But first, Ted Gerstein joins us. He's along with Richard Esposito. He's the author of Bomb Squad, A Year Inside, the nation's most exclusive police unit. In a few minutes, we'll also talk with a former member of the New York Police Department Bomb Squad. And we want to hear from you. If you have questions about life as a bomb technician, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on the blog of the nation at npr.org/blogofthenation, all one word. Ted Gerstein is a producer for ABC News Nightline. He joins us now from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
So why did you decide to shadow the NYPD bomb squad for a year?
Well, it started off as what a lot of these things do, as a Nightline piece. Richard Esposito and I worked on a lot of kind of first responder pieces following 9/11. And this was kind of the last one that we did. We followed around the bomb squad for what in television time is eternity, for about 3 months. And we got a very nice piece out of it. After that, Hyperion, a book company that Disney owns, also came to us and said, can you guys get back in for a year? And, after Richard, with Richard's experience with the police, and after the piece that we did for Nightline, I think we had built up a lot of goodwill and managed to get in there.
It's interesting. You talked about a series of pieces on first responders. This was the last one, and they think of themselves as the last responders.
Right. That's something that a lot of people don't understand, is that the bomb squad shows up after a long string of events have already taken place. After the cop on the beat sees the suitcase on the ground. After emergency services is called. So they're the ones that show up after the police lines are up and after the cameras have been pushed away.
And it's interesting that there are a lot of things that they do, of course, but there's a lot of things they don't do. They have a very specific job.
Right. They deal with what's in front of them. They get the call. They go out. There's a package at – there's a grenade at an armory. There's a package on the corner. That's what they deal with. There's really not a lot of follow-up. There's other units in the NYPD that deals with forensics. There's other units that deals with the investigations. They get rid of the bombs.
And this is an elite unit. In fact, you argue the most elite unit, not just in New York City, but anywhere in the country.
Well, it's the oldest bomb squad in the nation. It goes back to, 1903 through the various iterations. It started off as something called the Italian Squad, dealing with a group called the Black Hand, who would use dynamite to kind of extort newly arrived Italian immigrants. That, to me, kind of adds to the elite status of it. I mean, no one has that kind of history behind them.
Though you also point out it wasn't really a bomb squad in what we now think of it. It was as much of a red squad or a radical squad at various times.
And that's kind of the interesting aspect of it about it. They, up until through the 40s and basically after that too, they mirrored a lot of what America's fears were at the time. When they were the Italian Squad, it was kind of dealing with anarchists and black handers, as they were called. After that, it was forgeries. After that, it was communists. After that, and then they were anarchists. They had a spate where they were, where the number one villain in New York City was the projectionists union, who were throwing stink bombs into theaters in the 30s. They were kind of a catch-all for whatever was going on in the country.
And the event that changed them was a bomb at the New York World's Fair in 1940, believed to have been set off by the Irish Republican Army.
Right. No one quite knows quite yet, or no one's officially saying. But after that, that's kind of what's called the birth of the modern bomb squad. After that, they really kind of took a look at what they were going on, what they needed to do, what equipment they had, and kind of figured out this is what we need to do, and we need real equipment to do this. And one of the things that came out of it was this thing called the Pike LaGuardia truck, which was made with excess chains from the Brooklyn Bridge. And it's kind of a, it's a bathysphere. It senses you would put the device in it. If it explodes, the gases and the pressure escapes, but the shrapnel stays inside. And it was really you look at pictures of what it was before and afterwards, and there was some real equipment going on.
Interesting. You mentioned, of course, the history includes that attack allegedly by the IRA, German saboteurs during the First World War. Later in the bomb squad's history, many and some of them very deadly attacks by Puerto Rican separatist groups and Croatian nationalists. And yet you point out a lot of people in the bomb squad said, you know, we read in the newspapers after the first attack on the World Trade Center, this was the first foreign attack on American soil. Where were all these other bombs?
Right. And it's amazing the short attention span that I guess we all have. I mean, there's a chapter in the book about subways. And one of the things that we did was we went back to the New York Times and just found out the number of times the subway had been kind of targeted. And this was just in the first 20 years after the subway was built. There were headlines all through the New York Times. You know, it was angry unions. It was people trying to make a point. It was anyone with a beef. The subway seemed like an appropriate place to do it.
We're speaking with Ted Gerstein. He's the co-author of Bomb Squad. He's with us from our bureau in New York. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. And let's get Hal on the line. Hal's with us from Oregon.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for your Talk of the Nation. Your program is always fantastic. I was wondering, your experts on the bombs from the Bomb Squad, I'm sure have a lot of familiarity with fire departments and stuff. And I did not have a clue until someone told me on the 911, the Twin Towers, I was told and then researched it and haven't found otherwise that there has never been in the history of the world a steel frame building that has fallen over from just fire alone. And second and last, the two of the first firemen on scene and the first two on the radio had said, it looks like the 25th and 6th floor, if we get two lines up there, we can put this out. And I just wondered if they had a take on 911 and the Twin Towers.
Neil. Go ahead, please. Ted Gerstein?
Well, I mean, like everything, I mean, you could kind of look at 9/11 as what happened to the bomb squad, what happened is what happened to the rest of the police force, what happened to the fire department of the city. They were just taken completely aback by it. One of their members was killed, Claude Danny Richards was his nickname, and he was killed on that day kind of running back into the building to try to see what they could do. Specifically to the caller's question, no. I mean, these guys were involved just as everybody else was. They ran towards the danger like they always do.
Interesting. The period between the first bombing of the World Trade Center and the second is one that the lieutenant on the bomb squad, Mark Torrey, who you spent a lot of time with, he does talk about that as completely a missed opportunity.
Well, there was a lot learned from the first World Trade Center that could have been implemented. You know, one of the things that we point out in the book is that Giuliani put the Emergency Response Center back inside the World Trade Center, which maybe was not the best idea after it had been targeted once already.
There was also Mayor Rudolph Giuliani.
Rudolph Giuliani, yeah. There was also a report came out that the fire department radios were not functioning very well. Nothing was done with it. Yes, there were many lessons learned that could have been implemented, maybe should have been.
And many lessons learned after 9/11 that Lieutenant Torrey also says have not been learned. One of the things you quote him as saying is that just about every dollar spent on Homeland Security has been wasted.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that they found is that people look at the bomb squad as a catch-all, kind of like how I talked earlier about how history kind of relates them as a catch-all too. People look at the bomb squad as, let's get them to do security sweeps. Let's get them to watch everything. Let's get them to make sure that, you know, an entire parking lot is safe. That's not really their job. For example, I was hanging out with the bomb squad on New Year's Eve, and they got a phone call, you need to go sweep the Marriott Hotel. You know, that's not what they do. You can't take, you know, three dogs into a garage and have them and expect the whole thing to be safe and then have them walk away. That, I think, is they've been overtaxed after 9/11. And I think that's one of their problems. And I think throwing money and people at it isn't necessarily the problem.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Nell. Nell with us from North Carolina.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The heavy suits that we see these the bomb squad in, the big bulky suits and the heavy helmets and all, Are there some capabilities those suits have to keep you from getting so hot and sweaty and maybe passing out or something when you're having to work long times outside when it's so hot?
Well, why don't we bring another voice into the conversation, Kevin Barry. He's the senior advisor to the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators, and for nearly 20 years, a member of the New York City Police Department Bomb Squad. He's also with us from our bureau in New York. Kevin Barry, nice to have you with us on the program today.
Nice to be here with you, Neil.
And is there air conditioning in those suits?
There are cool suits available. It's an aftermarket product from the same manufacturer. Unfortunately, in New York, they told us it was only 2 months of summer and warm weather up here, so we didn't get them. But your time in that suit is probably looking at a 20-minute window, 22 minutes before your body core temperature starts to rise and it becomes a health issue.
So it's a little like going into a scuba dive, going underwater.
Correct.
And interesting, the armor in those suits, in reading the book, the armor is all in front. So you, even if you're backing away from a bomb, you back away from it.
That's correct. You walk forward and then you try and neatly walk backwards with all the equipment that you're backing away with, depending upon what option you're going to use to examine the device or possibly blow it in place.
Mm-hmm. And there's cushioning, and the cushioning is on the back in case you get blown back.
Yes, there is a spine protector on that suit. The major manufacturer is out of Canada. They did 25 to 30 years of research developing their suits, and they're now up to, I think, their number 10 model. It's made by MedEng, and it has the newer suits have a spine protector based upon the tests that they've done. One of their original developers and president of the company actually subjected himself to blast tests with live explosives wearing the suit. And after being knocked down numerous times, they decided to add the spine protector.
We're talking with Kevin Barry, a former member of the New York City Police Department's Bomb Squad, and with Ted Gerstein, who's a co-author of the book Bomb Squad and a producer on Nightline. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about life on the Bomb Squad, specifically the New York City Police Department's Bomb Squad. To get a feel for the job, you can read about the long walk a bomb technician takes when everyone else is backing away. It's at our webpage, npr.org/talk. Our guests are Ted Gerstein. He's the co-author of the book Bomb Squad, A Year Inside the Nation's Most Exclusive Police Unit, and with former NYPD bomb technician Kevin Barry. If you have questions about life as a bomb technician, if you've worked as a bomb technician, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And Ted Gerstein, it's interesting, there aren't actually all that many members of bomb squads, even around the whole country. And these units, at least according to the theories in New York, need to be small.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they're fairly elite units, and you don't want it to become unwieldy. You don't want members all over the place, because I think the problem comes down to what I was discussing before. You don't want them to become security for a city. You don't want them to have to hang out at, you know, piers and airports. You want them to be targeted. You want them to be called only when they're needed.
Yet the number of events in New York City, Kevin Barry, in the book they describe one sequence during 2004, the year that they spent inside the New York City Bomb Squad with, the United Nations session opens up. You've got opening days of baseball games in the Bronx and in Queens. You've got all kinds of things going on. There's a lot of work to do.
Yes, there is. Security sweeps, normal responses every day. It keeps the teams very busy.
And I was fascinated, Ted Gerstein, and Kevin Barry, I'd like your opinion on this as well. You write, Ted, that in fact the city of New York has been bombed a lot more often than people realize, and to a great deal less effect.
Well, New York is very elastic, I guess is what you can call it. You know, after the first World Trade Center, people were back on the subway the next day. People, it takes a lot to really disrupt the kind of the day-to-day flow of the city. And, I mean, that's one of the things that Mark Torrey kind of talks about is what is a bomb? What is it a device? And it doesn't matter if it's big. It doesn't matter if it's small. The idea is to make an effect, is to change people's lifestyle. And that's what get, you know, that's what they consider victory. And I guess you could argue that the bomb squad is there to make sure that, you know, that victory doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin Barry, you just focus on disarming the bomb no matter what it is.
That's correct. That's what your focus is. Normally, as Ted said, when the bomb squad arrives at the scene, everything is in place. The perimeter is set, cordoned off, access is limited, evacuation is normally taken place to a certain standard distance to give an operational feel for the bomb techs. The bomb squad brings a calming influence to the scene.
Hmm. I have to ask you, Kevin Barry, about a segment of this book in which the authors write about a real threat, thus far little reported, of nuclear devices in New York or Washington or both after 9/11, and that, in fact, the commander of the bomb squad, asked for people to volunteer to walk toward a nuclear device, which may have not have been very well shielded. No matter what they did, they probably would not have survived it. Is a nuclear weapon just another bomb?
It is not in itself. It's a special consideration that has to be given on something like that. The information that they had was given to be clear and present danger as far as the threat went. And there were very few options at the time as far as equipment assets that would be available. And with that in mind, that's where they asked people to on a volunteer basis only because of the high level of threat on that.
And Ted Gerstein, I have to ask you about this as well. Obviously, a lot of people officially would not talk about this story.
Right. Well, I mean, to me, the kind of the moral of the story is everybody asks me, why does someone join the bomb squad? You know, who is it that this type of person? And I asked a lot of people on the squad that same question over and over again. You know, a reporter, you try to get it different ways. And the answer always comes down to somebody's got to do it. And I think that's what happened in that case. You know, there's a general feeling that they call themselves an insurance policy, a very expensive insurance policy that nobody wants to pay for and nobody wants to deal with till they're around. They understand their role and they understand that's what they have to do. Again, it just goes down to you keep asking them, why do you do this? Why are you the guy walking towards danger? Somebody has to do it. And that fits into the kind of the quiet hero aspect that, you know, they don't like attention brought to themselves. There was kind of a lot of consternation in the squad when we wanted to do this was they don't want the spotlight brought on themselves. Nobody wants to be singled out. But I think it's a quiet heroism that I think needs to be singled out and shown.
Hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Jacob joins us. Jacob calling us from Florida.
Yes. This is I'd just like to say I appreciate you writing this book. I've had a couple of buddies of mine actually go over country in country and have actually died doing this. And it is one of those things that we are the last guys on the scene. We are the we're the guys that go down on the thing that nobody else wants to go down on. And I also want to say that you guys in New York, you guys aren't missing out. The cool suits don't help out that much. So they keep you cool for a little while, but the batteries die pretty quickly.
It sounds, Jacob, when you say in country, you mean Iraq?
Yes, in other places. The U.S. Army and or the military in general, we go on calls pretty much anywhere. I mean, we even do them in stateside, too. But when I do say I've had a couple of friends that have gone to Iraq and have died doing this. But it's like what they were saying, somebody's got to do it. And I think he's right. That's the mentality of everybody that I know that does this. That's the mentality.
I don't want to get into too many details, but are there fundamental differences between the kinds of bombs we see in Iraq, the IEDs, and the kinds of bombs that people like Kevin Barry dealt with in the city of New York?
Actually, I'm not going to discuss anything like that on over the phone or anything like that. I'm not even going to go into that.
Yeah. The one thing I would add is that, you know, bombers kind of in general, this is what we've learned, is it's not movies. It's not, you know, a Die Hard with a huge bomb, with a huge device, with, you know, dials and controls. Keep it simple, stupid is really the philosophy that both sides try to keep. Some explosives and a fuse is basically all you need. And I think it's pretty much the same here as it is there.
Right. And like I said, I thank you for writing this book. And again, New York, you guys aren't missing out. They're not that comfortable.
No, they put me in the suit for one evening, and it was not as fun as I was hoping.
No. Even with the even with the cooling system, it's not that cool.
Yeah.
Well, there is a difference between it gets hot in New York, but it ain't Baghdad. Anyway,
yep.
Jacob, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to, this is Raphael. Raphael calling us from California.
Yes. I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
When they joined the bomb squad, is it something that they have to study about how the chemicals or whatever that they're dealing with type of bomb works, or do they get taught once they join the squad?
I'm not sure I understood what you were saying.
Do they teach them, do they have to go to special school, or do they get taught once they join the bomb squad?
Kevin Barry, why don't you take that?
Neil, the technicians all go to the same school. There is one school in Huntsville, Alabama. It's the FBI's Hazardous Devices School, and everyone attends that school. Everyone in the country, there's probably between 4,000 and 5,000 certified bomb technicians today. Everyone goes through the same training, exactly the same. All the equipment in the country is basically exactly the same. There are different robotic platforms and a few new innovations in X-ray technology, old models versus new. Mm. But you can take a bomb technician or team from the West Coast, move them to Florida, and operate with each other with no problem whatsoever because they're all on the same page. There's a set of standards and guidelines that were developed in the 80s. And they provide the minimum standards, including training requirements, for every certified bomb squad in the country. The term that was brought up before, IED, we've been dealing with that term since the 70s. It's only come to light in this country due to the recent conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. NightLight actually did a piece at HDS in Huntsville, which, if I can plug myself, it's if you go to our bombsquadbook.com, we have a clip from it there, and you can really see what life is like inside the Hazardous Devices School. Mm. And it's an amazing place. They redid it a couple years ago, and they added there's scenarios for anything you can possibly expect. They've got a kind of mock Ted Kaczynski cabin there, a tiny little shack out in the woods. They have churches. They have supermarkets. They have airports. Any place that the public deal, that the public goes, that you might have a device, they can make the scenario for it. It's an amazing place.
Hmm. Raphael, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to, this is John. John's with us from Buffalo, New York.
Neil.
Yes.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I was listening to Jacob saying that somebody has to do this job. I was thinking about the amount of courage it takes, but not everyone can do the job. What do you consider to be the right stuff when you're looking for candidates to be a bomb technician?
Kevin Barry.
Well, our squad in the mid-80s went over a whole review, and the bomb squad commander, along with the FBI people, decided that we needed to increase the psychological testing for our bomb techs. We didn't want chance takers. We wanted risk takers to be the operational people.
It was interesting because it was not the kind of guys you think about. You know, like I said before, it's not the big, oversized, overcomplex bombs like you see in the movies, and they're not John Wayne types in the squad. They're very kind of quiet thinkers. They're suburban guys. They're not what you they don't run towards danger, and they don't want those kind of people in the squad.
I was also impressed by the amount of study and practice that's involved, not just training, and you have to be recertified every 3 years and that sort of thing, but the amount of time spent down in the archives in the basement of the facility that houses the bomb squad, looking over what happened when the FALN bomb happened at France's Tavern, for example.
There's an amazing it's not even a file cabinet. It's an amazing room down in the basement at the precinct that the squad is in, where they just go and there's boxes and boxes and boxes. It says 1915, and you just open it up and it's case files from the beginning of the century, going back to they've got the German spies. You know, there was a case where there was one particular spy who was trying to kind of push the United States into the war, set up a bunch of devices on steamships leaving New York Harbor. And they would the trigger mechanism was the number of turns that the rudder would make. There's the Mad Bomber. There's photographs of the Mad Bomber from the 1950s.
Actually,
there's the Sunday
Bomber.
Actually,
we have an email about the Mad Bomber. I remember the Mad Bomber, writes Manuel Rodriguez from the 50s, and seeing the bomb disposal truck running down Fifth Avenue. Who was the Mad Bomber? How much damage did he do?
Well, the Mad Bomber turned out to be a gentleman named George Metesky, and he was mad at Con Ed. that's what it was at the end of the day. He had a beef with Con Ed, and he claimed that they had given him kind of a lung problems, and he wanted some back money, and he wanted them to pay for his health care. And he went – he I think it was about 20 years total that he was kind of the main nemesis of the bomb squad. And this was the only case that we could find where there was ever kind of one particular person. There were FALN bomb makers, but there was one. George was the guy that kind of – who's the Hollywood type. And I talked to Bill Schmidt, who was the man that kind of was the bomb squad member that took him in 1956, I believe. And there was that kind of Hollywood moment where he said, "Hi, Bill, you know, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't out to get you. I was really out to get Con Ed." And it was a very kind of quiet, interesting moment.
We're talking with Ted Gerstein, a co-author of Bomb Squad, Inside a Year Inside the Nation's Most Exclusive Police Unit. He wrote it along with reporter Richard Esposito and with Kevin Barry, a former member of the New York City Police Department Bomb Squad, now senior advisor to the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Tacey. Tacey's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, what is the ratio of men to women on the bomb squads around the country? Are there more men or more women? And how does that influence the dynamic of the squad? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call. Kevin Barry, do you know the answer to that?
We had two women in the squad, both at different times.
Squad of how many?
Well, when I went on the bomb squad, we had 16 males. And during the next 20 years, we had two females come on the squad. One came in and left after several years, and the other spent several years and then retired. It is a job that requires a lot of physical strength, especially when you're encapsulated in a suit with 80 layers of Kevlar. And the women are encouraged in New York to try out for the squad, certainly. Throughout the country, there are many more women in the business today than there were 20 years ago.
There were a number of women at HDS when we were there also. So there are training. There are women. But it's definitely a male-dominated field just by virtue of it being a kind of a police business.
And you also described the New York City Police Department, in particular this unit, as there's one guy in particular who was the son of a bomb squad member who was, in fact, severely injured on the job.
Tony Senft.
Yeah.
Yes, his son is there now.
And there are an awful lot of police officers, including bomb squad members in New York, who's relatives of other police officers. It tends to be generational.
Sure, but that's just a function of it. You know, it's a good job.
Yeah. Here's an email question from Christopher in Tucson, Arizona, who's a psychiatrist. Are there significant stress-related problems like PTSD, depression, alcohol abuse among bomb squad members, or are these problems denied and swept under the rug as they are in so many police and fire departments?
I certainly think that they are aware of those. They don't sweep them under the rug. Maybe years ago it was something that they overlooked, but not today.
You know, Tony Senft, who was injured fairly seriously in a New Year's Eve bombing in 1983, started a support group. 1982, sorry, as Kevin just pointed out, got my dates wrong. Started a support group for kind of members of the not just the bomb squad, but police department to kind of talk about these issues and bring these issues out, because for a long time they didn't want to talk about it.
And one final question before we go. There are, of course, any number of false alarms to the real events, including, you described them in the book, Ted Gerstein, numbers of art projects, pipe bombs that, when they go off, start blinking lights.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, you could look at Boston, what happened with that, too, is the public is just hypervigilant now. And anytime they see anything, the call goes out, and there's a chain of command, and sometimes things can make it up to the top that maybe shouldn't have, and I think Boston is a perfect example of that. And for that one, I do throw a little bit of blame at the media.
Yet you also note that there's been an awful lot of bombs in the news lately, and artists tend to reflect the society around them, and one of the things they do is make art about bombs.
Right, and there was, I think that case was, there was a, I think there was the chapter, they did it for art, and he decided he wanted, you know, we live in a violent world. He wanted to make, you know, art with TNT, and, you know, some people just, that's their choice, and, you know, it is dangerous, and it could go off, and that's why the squad was called.
Interesting book. Thanks very much for being with us, Ted Gerstein.
Thank you.
Ted Gerstein, along with Richard Esposito, author of Bomb Squad, A Year Inside the Nation's Most Exclusive Police Unit. We'd also like to thank Kevin Barry for his time. Thanks for coming in.
You're quite welcome.
Kevin Barry, now senior advisor to the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking with the warden of Fallujah, a former Marine. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.